welcome our speaker tonight. It is Ben from Doylestown, and his home group is A Vision for You on Zoom.
Hello, my name's Ben, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Ben.
And thanks, Mike, for asking me to come out and speak. I've spoken here before, so I don't know. Hopefully, there's some new people here for those that have heard me speak before. It's been a while, but you'll just have to suffer through my story again. I am from Doylestown, Pennsylvania, although I just moved to Richland Town, so I'm not too far from here now. And I love the area, and I'm getting used to it, and it's nice to be able to come out here and sort of be a local now. So, I grew up in Doylestown. I'll give a little bit of background. My sobriety date is March 21st of 2013, and I'm certainly not a first-time winner by any stretch of the imagination, but in November of 2013, I was kind of winding down my last run, and I met a guy and eventually went through the steps and got sober in March of 2013, and my life radically changed at that point in time. I found contented, happy, so far lasting sobriety that's gotten better with time. Where my experience of sobriety prior to that point was I could get some time, but it would start off where I'd get a little bit of hope and I'd feel, you know, okay for a little bit, but then that untreated alcoholism, which is all the things that I drank and used substances to cover up, started to come back. And in the middle of going to a lot of meetings, going to therapy, going to outpatient, doing all kinds of stuff, you know, to support my sobriety, I'd start to feel suicidal, to be honest. I didn't know what was wrong with me. And it took me a long time to find my way through sobriety and meet the right person at the right time that started to help me to treat that condition, which is really going through the steps and treating alcoholism in a way that I hadn't heard before. So I'll try to talk about my experience with that. And that's all I have. So I think when I first went through the steps, it was like, oh my God, I didn't know that this was like you could have this experience in sobriety. So I care if you saw me at a meeting, I'd have my big book and I was like telling people, this is how you get sober. Everything else is crap, you know, and, a lot of people didn't like that message. So I'm not that adamant these days. I'm not like, running around with my big book trying to beat people over the head and get them sober. Cause really all I have is an experience, and I'll talk about that. And if you get something from it and you can identify with it, then that's awesome. But I'm not here to try to tell anybody exactly how to work their program. All I have is what worked for me. So I grew up in Doylestown. My parents are still together. I have a bunch of sisters and everybody seemed to, fit one mold and they got along well. They got along with life well. And I did up until I was probably 12 years old. And then, I don't know. I just like had a propensity to get in trouble. I started smoking cigarettes when I was 12. I started getting involved with like a little bit of vandalism. And I just started to get into trouble all the time. That seemed to be where it all began. And around that time when I was 13, I picked up my first drink. And I didn't, you know, I was pretty happy as a kid. I've heard a lot of stories of people that when they had their first drink or they had their first drug, it freed them from some kind of like an emotional prison, and it was like a spiritual experience. That wasn't true for me in the beginning. Towards the end, that definitely became a place that I needed to go to in order to get free, was to drink and use substances. But in the beginning, the first time that I drank, because I was a happy kid, and I really thought that I was going to have a pretty good life. Like, I figured I was pretty good in sports. I got good grades. I got along with people. I had friends. I was happy. I kind of figured, like, I'm going to live this life. I'm going to go to college one day. I'll get a good job. I'll get married. I'll have kids, and I'll live the American dream. And I really didn't see any reason why that wouldn't happen. So when I was 13, I had my first drink. The only thing apparent was that I really loved the effect produced by alcohol. But I also loved the way that I felt when I was sober. So it wasn't like I need to do this all the time, but it was like I really liked doing this. And the first time that I drank, and every time I drank after that, the goal was to drink until there was either no more booze around or I couldn't physically pick up a drink and drink anymore. So I drank to blackout the very first time that I drank. And, you know, it's like a typical alcoholic story. I did throw up all over the place. I did blackout. I did make an ass of myself, and I absolutely loved it. And I remember telling all my little derelict friends, like, we got to start drinking. Like, I don't know what we're doing, playing the tag or capture the flag or whatever that is. Like, we got to start drinking often. So go to your parents' house, like, fill up some, you know, cups with liquor and let's go get drunk. And so we did that as often as we could. You know, it's funny because, like, if you go through the big book, it starts to talk about different types of drinkers. And I was surrounded with this same group of guys probably till I was in my mid-20s when I really started to take off into my disease, and it scared even them. And they didn't want to be around me anymore. But for a long time, we drank alike and got into the same kinds of trouble. But at a certain point in time, they were able to, and some of them got like a DUI or an underage drinking or some kind of like a disorderly conduct or something like that. But at a certain point in time, all of them, except for one, and he's no longer with us, my best friend, all the other ones were able to just step back and go like, okay, this isn't fun anymore, or it's time to get serious about life, or maybe I should go back to college, or maybe I should kind of stick with this girl that I'm with and try to see if there's something that can go further there, and they get married or, you know, start a business or whatever it is. And some of them quit drinking entirely, but most of them just, you know, I still keep in contact with some of them, and they drink every now and again, and, you know, they went on with life. But that wasn't my experience. So, through high school, I would look at like addiction and alcoholism. I'll call it the same thing. I started with drinking. I tried everything else along the way. I got addicted to everything else along the way. I could enter any 12-step program just about and qualify. Anything that filled me up in that space inside that I started to feel empty in, I tried it. Whether it was relationships, drugs, alcohol, gambling, spending money, you name it, I tried it and I abused it. But I started with alcohol, and the last substance that I used was alcohol, and you know, everything in between, so you can use your imagination. But with respect to Alcoholics Anonymous, mainly I'm just talking about alcohol, my relationship with alcohol. But when I was in high school, I look at it like I didn't see it's alcoholism such a weird thing because I could see that like I was getting in trouble more. I could see that there was arguments going in, on in my family around my drinking and my behavior. I could see that my grades were slipping. I could see that I started to not really care so much about college and sports and the things that I used to care about. My grades were okay, but they weren't great. They were always like, I was like a straight A student, and then I started to become like a CB kind of student, and I didn't care. I started to hate authority. And meanwhile, drinking and partying just kind of came into the forefront of my mind, and it's really all that I thought about was like drinking, partying, and girls. You know, it was kind of like, that's the only thing that I ever really thought about. And it's really the only thing that I did was drink, on the weekends. And, I started doing things that you could do during the week. But still, I was fine if I wasn't drinking. I felt great. And then, my experience with sobriety and with drinking and with, I don't know how to put it, like states of consciousness, if that means anything to anybody. I've always been like really sharp. And I'll say it like this. I went to senior week. I don't know if any of you guys remember what that was or experienced that. It's like you graduate from high school and you go down to the beach for the week and you pretty much just drink 24/7, or at least that's what I did. And so I remember like I packed this arsenal full of all kinds of booze and dry goods, you know, and went down to senior week and partied the whole week. And I had a great time. And the last day that I was there, I remember sitting on a couch with a bunch of my friends, and I was sober. I was probably hungover, but I was sober. And I remember feeling anxiety. And I don't know, I mean, most of us that are in this program probably know a bit about anxiety. I had never experienced it. And so my heart started racing, and I started to get kind of paranoid and feel really uncomfortable in my own skin around people that I grew up with. And this kind of voice inside of my head that used to kind of tell me, see, I thought I was like a legend in high school in my own mind, you know? I had this grandiose idea of myself, and it was all, my thoughts were positive. It was like, you're awesome. You're gonna, you know, everybody wants to be your friend, you know, all this stuff. Delusions of grandeur. And this voice started that day where I had the anxiety, and it just was a whisper at first, which was like, what's wrong with you? You're crazy. And mayday, you know, mayday, mayday. This is something bad here. And also, keep this a secret. Don't tell anybody. There was like shame involved. I don't know why, but I didn't want to tell anybody that I was scared or that possibly there was something wrong with me. And I thought, and honestly, I wrote this thought out. See, I was 18 then. I got sober when I was 37. So the better part of 20 years, there was always this thought that one day this will end and I'll come out. And that wasn't the case. It didn't end of its own accord. I had to do some work. And I wouldn't say that it ended, but it's changed. But this began a downward spiral into some unfamiliar territory where I lived pretty much inside my head, if that makes sense to anybody. And what that means is I might be in a conversation with someone. I went to college. I might go to class. I might have roommates. I might have some interactions with my family and friends and all this stuff, but it was really robotic. And I was stuck inside of myself, just trying to get through each moment and the whole time just trying to hide what was going on inside of me, which was just like tremendous fear, insecurity. I was lost. And really, I had no business being in college at that time or doing really anything. I should have really been trying to address what was going on with me instead of just masking it with more alcohol and more substances. It was the route that I took. Because when I drank, I temporarily could come out of that pretty painful state of mind. So I used to drink because it was fun. And now I drank pretty specifically to come out of a mental and emotional prison. And I was still having fun, and just, I would tell myself, like, I would drink, I would come out of that place, I would be the life of the party, and then I would wake up the next day, and the hangovers were horrible, because not so much that I remembered what I did the night before, but because I knew that I was going to be back in that cage, the bars were going to close again, until the next time that I drank. And I wasn't a daily drinker at this time, so I had a lot of pain going on. But I started to become a daily drinker. And I wasn't a morning drinker yet, but eventually that would come. So I'm kind of like wandering around this college campus and not really, I couldn't focus on school. I couldn't focus on anything that most kids were doing in college, getting involved in things, finding out what they want to do with their lives, getting internships, all that other stuff. I was just going to class to show up, and most of the time, I really didn't even do that. I would just lie in bed. I was really depressed. And then I would wait, and I wouldn't let anybody know. And then I could mask it pretty well. I learned how to kind of just put on a front that I was okay, and then drink. And eventually that sort of started to crash and burn. My grades suffered, so I took some time off of college. And during that time, I remember telling my parents, like, something's wrong. You know, something's wrong with me in my head. Like, I'm having, you know, these experiences. So I started going to psychiatrists and psychologists around that point in time, and taking medications for depression and anxiety. And ADD, so I'm taking, like, you know, these amphetamine type of medications, and now I'm, like, on amphetamines, I'm on these other medications, I'm drinking, and I'm just, like, a freaking mess. And drinking on all these you know, these drugs, these prescription drugs, my behavior started to get crazy. I wasn't, like, a violent person, but I became violent. I was getting into fights all the time. I was getting arrested all the time. Before I even turned 21, I think I had 8 underage drinkings and a DUI. I had lost my license for 7 years. I got another DUI and a suspended license, lost it for, I think in total, I ended up getting a third one later. I had lost my license for 15 years. And now I'm getting in trouble with my family. They don't know what's going on. They're trying to help me. None of us really understand that I'm actually an alcoholic, you know, because I could hide that a little bit, and I sort of looked like everybody else at my age, like I was going to the bars, you know, but I was getting in a lot of trouble, and I was just convinced, and my family was convinced, that I just have bad luck, because I seemed to be at the wrong place at the wrong time. But if you're always drinking, and you're always doing crazy stuff while you're drinking, you're going to be in the wrong place at the wrong time all the time, which was true for me. I ended up moving out of my house and moving into Philadelphia with this girl that I was dating at the time. She was going to Drexel University, so I moved in with her, and she liked the party, so that worked out for me. But what happened is, when I moved there, I found some other substances that previously in my life I would have never tried. It was like an after-school special kind of thing started to happen. Now I'm doing these substances, and now I really have to hide it. But now the cool thing, at least I thought at the time, was I could do these substances all day and actually function pretty well. So I was working at the time. I started going back to college at a branch campus of the college I was going to, and I was actually doing pretty well. I remember I'm doing these substances, and I wasn't drinking as much. So I called my family and was like, good news, guess who's not drinking? And they were like, that's amazing. I'm like, yes, yeah. I really thought that I had found the key to going on from here out. Like, I thought I could just consistently do a little bit in the morning, a little bit at noon, a little bit later in the night, and for the rest of my life, like, this is how I could pull this off, and this is how I could live. I didn't realize what was about to happen was I was going to absolutely fall into the darkest pit internally and externally for the next decade or so. Let's just say really quickly, I lost just about everything. I was living on the street, on and off of the street, in the woods. I was walking through the streets of Kensington and Philadelphia with no shoes, you know, robbing, stealing, and doing whatever I had to do to support the next thing that I could put in my body. I was drinking around the clock, and I was doing drugs around the clock. I began to come home for periods of time, steal from my family, get violent with my family. And basically, I was just a 24/7 trying to fill something inside me so that I didn't have to experience what was also getting worse, was my mental and emotional state, you know, when I was sober. I couldn't live. I needed drugs and alcohol, probably worse than a lot of people need food, you know. It was, I had to have it in my system. I couldn't stand being alive without something to anesthetize myself. And so it was keeping me alive, because I was radically suicidal. So it was keeping me alive, but it was also killing me physically, mentally, spiritually, at the same time. I remember coming home one evening, and I was like staying at my parents' house, I think, for a couple days. And I was in a blackout. I had been drinking all day. I don't think I was using drugs at this point in time, but I was drinking a lot. And the drinking became, I would drink anything that contained alcohol, whether it was like cooking wines, scope, vanilla extract, because I didn't have all that much money. So if it had alcohol in it, I was drinking it. And most of the time I could scrape together a little bit of money or steal liquor from anywhere. So I was drinking around the clock. And I remember coming home, and I was in a blackout, and I got this some kind of altercation. I remember the next day, or it was the next morning, my dad said, he came into my room, or the spare room, and he said, your mom and I and your sisters, I had little sisters, are gonna go out for the day. And when we get back, we don't want to see you again. Get all your stuff together, get whatever you need. Don't steal anything, but get whatever you need. And if we see you again, we're calling the police. If we see you anywhere near this property, we're calling the police. And I understood. And I said, okay. And I knew the gig was up, because I could always go to my mom and convince her, you know, I could convince her to give me one more chance. And I saw her. She was like behind my dad, and she was crying, but he wouldn't let her come in to get manipulated by me. So that happened. As soon as he left, I found some money somewhere, I forget where, and I reached underneath the bumper of a car, found some keys, you know. I don't know if they do that anymore, but back in the day, cars would have a spare set of keys standard underneath, like, the back of the bumper. A lot of them did anyway, and one of ours did, and I got those keys, and I took that car. And my plan that day was to commit suicide, and I was convinced. I mean, it's a strange thing, not me to, like, dramatize it. But the only reason I know I was going to do it that day is because there's two times I felt like something break inside of me and I felt peace. One was when I made that decision. I just knew something, like the will to live, like, broke. And I was like, I'm done. And I was like, all right. So I just was methodically heading to where I was going to go. My plan was to overdose. So, and the second time that happened was during my most authentic third step, when this something broke, and that same peace came over me, and it hasn't left. It's only deepened since then, thank goodness. And occasionally I could chemically induce a similar feeling, which is why I know what we've always been looking for is some sort of a spiritual experience, some sort of letting go. I just always was looking for it in booze and drugs. I didn't realize that I actually needed to have it happen authentically, and that there was a way to do that. And there is. That's why I'm here. That's why these steps are here. So I took that car. I ended up getting pulled over on the way to go do what I was going to do. I was already drunk because I stopped at the liquor store because I wasn't going to kill myself sober. I knew I needed a little bit of courage. I'm going to speed this up, but I got pulled over. Cop comes up to the window. It was like 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning. And he was like, you know how fast you were going? I was like, you know, I had no idea. And he said, you know, you're speeding down here. Where are you headed? I made up some story. And he said, he looked over and there was a pint of vodka empty on my seat. And he was like, have you been drinking? I was like, no, that's from, you know, last night. And he was like, I mean, you stink like alcohol. And it's 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning. Like, he's like, license and registration. And I handed him a walking ID because I didn't have a license. It was suspended for a long time. And he looked at it and he was like, a walking. He's like, are you telling me you don't have a license? And I was like, and he's like, hold on. And he went back to his car to like, you know, check all kinds of things. And so I took off in the car. And the next thing I know is like, there's all these cops behind me and I'm flying down these back roads. I'm in a brownout. I wasn't blacked out, but I was pretty close to it. And, I just jerked the wheel. I just right off the highway towards the woods and the car flipped, I don't even know, 6 or 7 times. And I came to, upside down. I must have hit my, I did hit my head, but, otherwise I was okay. I was underneath the glove box and, I didn't have my seatbelt on, or else I'd not, I mean, everybody should wear their seatbelt, but in this case, if I had, I would have been crushed. But I was underneath the glove box and, I could hear this machine. So they were doing like the jaws of life, you know, they saw the roof off and flipped the car back over. They pulled me out and, the cop basically said, I went to the hospital and the cop came in and my family was there and my dad's crying, my mom's crying. And I'm like, I was like pissed because I didn't get, like I was alive and now I get to deal with this. Like, I just didn't want to, I didn't want to deal with life. I didn't want to deal with cleaning up messes. I didn't want to deal with having to get sober. I didn't want to have to deal with upsetting you. I didn't want to have to deal with anything. And so I was just pissed. I'm like, why are you crying? I'm the one that got in the accident. You know, I'm the one that's suffering. And the cop was basically like, you can go to jail or you can go to a mental institution. So I went to a mental institution at Building 50 in Norristown. And like, you're supposed to be there for a 3-day evaluation, but I convinced my roommate that his, fentanyl patch would probably better serve me than him. And, he agreed. And, so I stayed in there for like 30 days just getting high off of the other patients' medication. And actually, they kicked me out of Building 50. They were like, you're an addict and an alcoholic. You're not crazy. And I was like, I mean, I feel pretty crazy. And they're like, yeah, but you're not like the rest of these guys. So, I ended up leaving. Then I went right from there to jail and I was in jail for a year. And I was doing the same stuff in jail. You know, I found ways to get high in jail and to even drink in jail. The last 6 months I was in jail, I knew that if I continued this path, that I was going to end up in a car again, headed to go kill myself again. And I kind of was like, you know, gave me time to reflect. And I really thought like, I'm going to do it. So I started going to like these like Bible studies and these big book meetings, not big book meetings, AA meetings that they brought in there. And I really thought that I had made a change. And I even got like, I was really unhealthy when I got there. And I started lifting weights and, you know, playing basketball and I was going to drug and alcohol classes. I became like the leader of my little drug and alcohol group. And, you know, I was like, all right, I can do this. 12 days after I got out, I was nodding out in the church pew. So that one kind of really confused me until I learned a bit about what it means to be an alcoholic. And, I'm going to fast forward. I went through a period of like sober, through just going to a lot of meetings and then relapsing and sober and relapsing and sober and then drinking again and sober and drinking again. And then finally I got like 4 years where I was sober and, I didn't do any steps really. Like occasionally I would do a little work in a pamphlet, like write out why I thought I was an alcoholic and maybe have like a first step. I'd say the third step prayer with somebody like, but I was going to meetings where a lot of people would say like, I think that's sort of why it's important to have a common, like a common message, at least for me anyway, the only way I know to get sober for a real alcoholic, for me, for someone like me, is through the actions contained in the 12 steps and the fellowship of AA surrounding that. I don't know it's the only way. I know that it worked for me. And as far as AA is concerned, that really is the message. The recovery is contained there. The fellowship is here. But I was going to meetings that didn't, nobody ever said that. They said, like, I was going to this beginner's meeting and it was like, everybody would share, how did you stay sober this week? And one person would say, like, you know, I went to a meeting every day. I called my sponsor every day and I went to the gym and like I picked up chairs after every meeting. And I'd be like, okay, I'm going to do that. And then the next person would say, like, you know, I went to church. I talked to a newcomer. I welcomed them. I gave rides to people coming out of rehab. And so I would do, well, not the rides part. I didn't have a license, but I would do everything else. And the first year I was like, holy crap, I got a year sober. Like, I'm still pretty crazy inside. I still feel all that stuff inside, but I'm like a little bit better. I'm feeling like hopeful. I've got like, my life is starting to go somewhere. I've got a job. I'm living back at home. I'm arguing with my family a lot. I still have tons of damage from the past. My life is by no means like reflecting good and healthy sobriety, but it's starting. And then year two, I'm like, this anxiety's getting a little bit worse. This depression's getting a little bit worse. I still feel like I'm in a cage, but people are telling me, hang in there, kid. It gets better one day at a time. Wait for the miracle. Go to another meeting. Share that. Oh, how many times did I share that stuff? I was like, I'm sharing it and it's still there. Like, how good is this? People are like, I was getting so mad. Like, this is nuts. And then I would see like Bob come in and 30 days later, he's like, you know, feeling great. And I'm like, Bob is not like me. Bob's not like me. Like, I'm suffering, and so I don't want to like necessarily say it, because now I'm like one of the people that other people think have good sobriety, because I've been like, I'm bad, I'm an alcoholic, I'm sober today, by the grace of God, I've got 3 years and I'm doing well. Inside, I need a drink so bad I can almost taste it, and I want to die. And by year four, I drank again, obviously, and I came back in, and I ended up meeting a guy. I heard him talk, and he wasn't from my area, and he was talking maybe something similar to what I'm saying now, and I hadn't heard it before, and I knew that this guy, I knew that he knew what I was feeling, and I also knew that he was having an experience that I hadn't seen anybody else have. And so I grabbed him before he left the meeting and said, can you take me through those steps the way that you went through? And he said, yeah. So I went out to New Jersey where this guy lived, and we went through the steps, and we went through pretty fast. And at first he was like, you know, we're going to boogie down, you know, we're going to do this. And it was like a month for me. And he said, even that, it's a little bit longer than he likes to go through taking people through the steps. Now, I personally, I don't have that kind of time frame. There are some people I'm able to take through the steps that quickly, depending on availability and all that stuff. But it's still pretty quick. But I was exposed to an AA that was like steps. Most of the people I knew that had like 5-6 years were like, I'm still in my fourth step. And, you know, and I'm like, okay. Or, you know, people like have 10 years and like, well, I do a living amends. I haven't, you know, I'm still working on my ninth step. And I'm like, okay. So it's like, you know, there's something you take. It's like throughout your whole life, you just kind of filter the steps in. So when he was like, we're going to go through quick, I was like, hold on, you know, like if there were AA police, I would have called him on this dude and been like, you got to see what this guy's doing. This is like some crazy stuff. I remember I had a sponsor, and like people would come in, and every once in a while, like some random like anomaly would come in and be like, I'm on my fourth step, and they'd have like 30 days, and my sponsor would be like, that guy's gonna drink. He's moving way too fast. And I'd be like, yeah. I,
yeah, I didn't want to move that fast back then.
So I had this whole different version of AA, and he started reading me the book, and he started to explain to me that, like, you know, for however long alcoholics were dying, up until the 1930s, like, basically, if you were a chronic alcoholic, you were ending up in a mental institution or you were dying. And that 1930s, these guys came up with, like, a step-by-step process to have this spiritual awakening. And as they went through the process and had the awakening themselves, and then went out and taught that same process to other people, people began to recover. So, like, that the process of recovery has always been to take action to have a spiritual awakening, and then teach the spiritual awakening. And AA wasn't even a thing yet. He's like, so this is where the recovery happens. And then AA formed around that so that these people can meet and talk. And I was like, he's like, you've been in the fellowship. He's like, it's like you've had cancer and you've gone to the hospital and you've talked to the doctors and you've met with other patients, but you never took the therapy. You never took the medication. And I knew he was right. And I was like, well, what do I have to do? And he started talking to me about alcoholism in a way that I hadn't heard before. And he opened up the book to page 52. And page 52, there's this description of alcoholism, untreated. They call it the bedevilments. And it says, basically, does this describe you? And he asked me that, and he read these descriptions of what it feels like to be sober, but not drinking, but also not having a spiritual experience yet. And it said, we were a prey to misery and depression. We're having personal trouble. Couldn't seem to make a living. Couldn't seem to be of real use to other people. We're unhappy. And it says, basically, isn't a solution to these bedevilments the most important thing? And I was like, that describes me 100%. And he said, well, that's what we have to do. He said, because you have that is the description of untreated alcoholism. And you're going to treat that condition no matter what. A guy like you is going to treat that condition above everything else. You can't live that way because you'll become suicidal. And I said, yeah. And he said, so you're either going to treat it, you're going to treat alcoholism with alcohol. And that was the first time that somebody nailed it for me. Because I knew if I didn't find a way to treat whatever was going on inside of me, I had to use something, or I wasn't going to make it. And when I was going to meetings before, the emphasis was, put the substance down, then you'll feel better. My experience is, I put the substance down, and I have an open wound. And no matter whatever human power I use to try to cover that wound, whether it's a girl, whether it's nice clothes, whether it's a good job, whether it's money, eventually that band-aid falls off and there's just this gaping wound. And really the band-aid's only there so that you don't see it. I can always feel that wound. And so I started to understand alcoholism from a different perspective. And we began to go through the steps, and I started to have my first experience with what I understood, like, that I was an alcoholic. I would raise my hand in all the meetings and therapies that I would go to before and be like, I'm an alcoholic. Obviously, I love drugs and alcohol. I have to have it, and it's ruined my life. But I didn't understand what it really meant to be an alcoholic from a physical standpoint, from a mental standpoint, as a disease. And when he started to explain in the doctor's opinion that I have a body that's different, like why I can't control the amount that I take, whether it's drugs, whether it's alcohol, I can't just have one. Like, to be perfectly honest, if I could find a way to use a substance and just keep it right here and do that thing that I thought I could do, a little bit in the morning, a little bit in the afternoon, a little bit in the evening, consistently, then I wouldn't be in this fellowship. I'd be doing that on a consistent basis and probably doing pretty well at life. But I can't keep it there, and I can't control the amount I take once I start, and I never could. And so he he started to explain to me that I have a body that's different from the normal drinker. And I started to see that through my experience. He would say, is this true for you? What's your experience? Could you ever control it? And I couldn't. And he said, it's not because you're weak. It's not because you're a piece of crap. It's because you have a body that's different from other people. And that took like a lot of weight off my shoulders, because I would hear people, even in AA, well, why'd you drink again? I'd be like, I don't know. Well, you didn't want it bad enough, you know? And I started to understand that, like, why I drank again is because I lost the power of choice. That I have a mind that, you know, it's like in the mind, there is a spot, and let's just say there's like these little electrons firing, and it's willpower. And they are always available for certain areas of my life. I can kind of think and then address my power of will and do all kinds of awesome stuff. You know? I can will all kinds of things in life. Now, when I go to use that same, access that same power as it comes to just not drinking, it fires sometimes. And sometimes I can do that. But the one day it misfires and it's not available is the day that I find myself drunk again, or I find myself drinking again. Or, you know, for whatever reason, I have this thought that's like, I'm kind of thirsty, but this thought that's more powerful that says, not today, it's going to ruin your life, you're an alcoholic. And then one day, they go like this, and this one's stronger than this one, and the thought of drinking is more powerful than the thought to stay sober. And I don't know which day that's going to end up being. I never know. So I can't access this mind to just not do it. And even if I could, honestly, I was in so much pain that why would I do that anyway? I just don't do it so I can suffer. Like, that's not happening. I don't know about anybody else. I don't suffer well. So I started to understand that, like, it wasn't because I didn't care about my family. It wasn't because I didn't even care about my own life. It wasn't because I wanted to ruin everything. It wasn't because I was a moral, just like, worst piece of crap ever, which is what I thought. It was because I had a mind and a body that were alcoholic. And when I understood that, any defense that I had against going further in the steps dropped, because I knew that this was right. And I knew that I had a disease, and I knew I better take care of this first and foremost, or nothing will ever come in my life, ever. And I'm going to suffer and probably just live in and out of jail and institutions for the rest of my life. Because I knew I had this thing. Now I knew I had it. You know? It's like, maybe you're sick for a while, and you just don't want to go to the doctor, so you just pretend like, I'll get better or something like that. And then you go to the doctor and they say, well, you've got stage whatever cancer, and now you have to take these treatments. You can no longer, like, lie to yourself. When I knew that first step was true for me, I couldn't deny it. And it was a huge relief, but now I have to take care of it. And so we went through, and I'm not going to go through all the steps, but when I found out, he said the root of my problem in the big book is, he said, what do you think the root of your problem is? And I would say substances and my relationship to them. And he would say, well, that's a part of your problem, but the root of your problem is selfishness and self-centeredness. And it was right there in the big book. And he said, we have to kind of dig that out. We have to get below the surface. He said, it's like a weed, and you've been going to AA for years, and you're just pulling the green part of the weed, which is the arrests, which is the actual drinking, and all the different things, consequences of my actions. But you never dug down deep to get that root out, which is that page 52, all those bedevilments. You never addressed that. And he said, so selfishness and self-centeredness is the root. You're so self-centered on yourself that you can't see and experience anything else, and you're disconnected from life. And when you live in that state, you have to drink to come out of it. And he was like, that's that emotional and mental prison you've been telling me that you went into when you were 18. We have to figure a way to root you out of that. And it's based in you're so absorbed in yourself. And I thought, like, well, that's BS. I'm a nice guy, you know. I'm shy. I'm like, I hate myself. How could I be selfish? I could see when I'm using that I did some selfish things. When I was drinking, I did some selfish things. But when I'm sober, I'm like a mouse. You don't even know I'm there. I can't even connect. I don't know how to like even talk to people, let alone be selfish. And he was like, okay, well, you tell me all the time how much you hate yourself and how you have all this guilt over what your life has become, about all the things you've done to your family, about all the relationships you've ruined, about all the harm you've caused people. And again, like, what a piece of crap you are. How often do you think about those things? And I was like, is that what they're talking about? Because that just runs. It's just like a stream that runs 100% of the time. I go to sleep to it. I wake up to it. If I wake up in the middle of the night, I wake up to it. I go throughout my day. It shrinks a little bit to the background while I'm busy, but I can feel it. I feel like a piece of junk. I experience, you already can see, I'm a piece of junk. I'm full of shame. I don't lift my head up when I'm walking. I don't lift my head up to look at people. I don't like to look at my reflection in the mirror. And I just experience pain. And he said, well, you think maybe we should address that? Well, maybe it'd be a small part of the problem. So the steps became a way to the fourth step, the fifth step, sixth and seventh, really became a way for me for the first time to take a viewfinder that looked out here. I could blame life pretty easily for the way that I felt and why I had to do what I had to do. It's the only reference point I had. It had to be because my dad was an a-hole. It had to be because my sisters got treated better. It had to be because the police were always on my back. It had to be because I had depression and anxiety that I didn't cause. It had to be because whatever. And this was the first time that I took that lens and just shined it back here and really wrote about it. I really looked at how I showed up in life. And I'll tell you what, like, there were obvious things that I did. I lied a lot. I stole things. I caused harm all over the place. That was pretty obvious. But for me, it was more of the subtle things. Like, not showing up for people. Not being honest. Not loving people. Not feeling remorse. I had one resentment against my dad. You've heard this story, but it was the most powerful one because I had this story of, like, I hated him, you know? Like, I was so mad at him, and I thought he didn't love me. And he was really, like, the focal point of a lot of the stories that let me use and drink for so long. And I did this resentment inventory, and I looked at, like, what he did to me, my story, this is what he did. And then I looked at, like, what it affects, my self-esteem, my pride, my personal relationships, you know, and it affected everything. And I kind of got to see that, like, I gave this story of him, like, all this power to produce this effect in me and affect all these things. And then I did this, like, sick man's prayer where you kind of go, well, help me to see him as a sick person and be kind and tolerant and please God help me here. And then I did a fourth column, which was like, well, where was I? Selfish. And it was like, from 13 till 37, I lied to him 99% of the time. How are you doing? Like, good, fine. Leave me alone. Stole from him. Lied about everything. I just lied. He was, like, really active, and he coached all my little league teams and all that stuff. And, like, I started to remember all this stuff. And I started to see that, like, I left my family when I was probably 13. I stopped showing up to stuff. I started to, get into all kinds of trouble. Like I said, I started to lie. And So where was I selfish? Like, I stole from him, I stole money from him, I lied to him, I stole his cars, I looked at dishonesty. Where was I dishonest? Everything was dishonest. Where was I self-seeking? And one thing was, like, I really saw that, like, I never, he would at least ask, like, are you okay? How are you doing? You know? I never once in all those years said, hey, how are you? You know? Are you happy? Can I do something for you? Those words never, I never uttered those words. It was like, give me money, give me this, give me that. If you don't and you're mad at me because I haven't, like, mowed the lawn, well, F you, and also, where's your wallet? And see ya. This is my dad, and that's how I treat him, and I couldn't see why he was always seemingly so angry at me. It just, like, was a revelation to me. And I remember telling my parents, I'm going through these steps, and believe it or not, they're saying that, like, the root of my problem, I always thought it was drugs and alcohol, is selfishness and self-centeredness. And they were like, stick with that guy. Like, yeah, you've been this way since, like, for forever. I'm going to fast forward, but I went through those steps with every fiber of my being. I didn't miss anything that this guy, any meeting, I was there early. I stayed a little bit later to talk to him about spiritual things. I went through a fear inventory, I went through a relationship inventory, and I just looked at myself even deeper in all those ways. And I've gone back through a bunch since then. I went out and made really hard amends. But I just, like, as a shell of a human being that couldn't look people in the eyes, I would drag my ass to doors and knock on them and say, here's how I harmed you. You might not even be aware of it. I stole this from you, neighbors. I stole this from you. I broke into your house. I helped you look for the people that did it. It was me. You know, like, some really hard amends, and going to family members and some ex-girlfriends where it was appropriate. Let's talk about that stuff with your sponsor. And I started to have this experience of just, like, coming out of that prison without having to take a substance. And it's, like, the craziest thing, because I just had a radical experience. And some people have it more slowly and some have it pretty quickly. I had it, like I said, my experience of consciousness, of experiencing what it feels like to be inside this body, has always been pretty stark and pretty radical. And for me, this idea of who I thought I was and all that mental chatter and this, like, straitjacket that I wore, everything just burst. And it's not that it doesn't try to come back, but I have a way to watch in step 10. I meditate, for me, hours, a couple hours a day. Something, I landed somewhere inside of this system when I close my eyes and shut in. That's just euphoria and presence of all that I can say is my experience of God. And the more I do that, the longer I do that, I just sit in that place. And life can be what it is, and that's just my spiritual experience. My relationships have come together effortlessly. I was tens of thousands of dollars in debt. Somehow, in a really short period of time, my credit came back. I got my license back. I got a car, a bank account. My family, the relationship couldn't be better. I have a healthy relationship, romantic relationships. One, but I've had a couple along the way. One currently. My relationship at work is, like, my bosses trust me, all that stuff, but I don't care about anything other than feeling that presence and, like, trying to help other people, because it's inside of us. It's not like, well, if you're lucky, you'll get that. It's like, well, no, you can actually take some action and have this happen. And it is, some people grow into it more slowly and some have, like, a profound experience. I think it's probably whatever your relationship is to that pain is probably to what extent you can you can grow spiritually. And me, I wasn't going to make it, and I needed a pretty big experience, so that's what happened for me. But go out and find out for yourselves, and hopefully you got something from that message. Thanks.